I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
We will end the sanctuary cities that have resulted in so many needless deaths. Cities that refuse to cooperate with federal authorities will not receive taxpayer dollars, and we will work with Congress to pass legislation to protect those jurisdictions that do assist federal authorities.
That was candidate Donald Trump speaking a few months ago. President-elect Trump has said that ending funding for sanctuary cities is something he will do within the first 100 days of his new administration. These are cities like Philadelphia that limit cooperation with federal immigration officials when it comes to enforcing immigration policies like refusing to hold people for some immigration violations. Now, immigration is a federal responsibility and one of the more contentious issues facing the country. I should add that President Obama has been called the deporter in chief, having deported more than 2 million people who are in the country in defiance of immigration laws. Well, today on Radio Times, sanctuary cities and a potentially costly showdown with the Trump administration. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Peter Spiro is the Charles Wiener Professor of Law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. He's got a new book called At Home in Two Countries about dual citizenship. And Peter Spiro, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Always glad to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. Also with us, Jan Ting, a professor also at Temple University Beasley School of Law. From 90 to 93, he served as Assistant Commissioner at the Immigration and Naturalization Service of the U.S. Department of Justice. He's also a blogger here at WHYY. And Jan Ting, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you again.
And we have done this before with the two of you, debating and discussing immigration. One of the things I learned in doing my homework for this hour of Radio Times is that there are lots of different definitions of what a sanctuary city is. There are a number of sanctuary cities. In my own mind, I think of them as cities who have decided to limit cooperation with immigration officials when it comes to immigration violations. Kind of a clunky definition, but Jan, can we go with that?
Well, I go with a broad definition of sanctuary cities, and those are cities that just don't cooperate in the enforcement of U.S. immigration laws. I think immigration laws, like all laws in the United States, can be challenged, can be criticized, but until they're changed, they need to be respected and enforced. I think our law enforcement agencies are under attack, and it's normal for law enforcement agencies to look to other law enforcement agencies for backup. And, you build that relationship by cooperating with other agencies in their missions. And that's normally, in my understanding, having worked at the INS, how the INS always treated it. We want to cooperate with other agencies. Other agencies are expected to cooperate with us. That's normal. And I think we have a political situation now where, for political opportunist reasons, elected officials have decided to step in and disrupt that normal relationship that I think rank and file street officers want.
Well, I want to pick up on that. Peter, let me give you a chance to weigh in. And I don't want to get bogged down with definitions, but I want to make sure we all know what we're talking about here.
Yeah, so I think it's non-cooperation in the sense of not actively working to enforce the immigration laws. And there's actually a constitutional law under which state and local law enforcement can't be brought to work for purposes of enforcing federal law. It's more a kind of passive resistance than an active resistance. And I think this is completely appropriate in our federal system for state and local jurisdictions that are more friendly to immigrants than other jurisdictions to say, look, we're just not going to be a part of this.
Well, let me quote something that we got from the Kinney administration here in Philadelphia. We asked them to send us what the policy is for Philadelphia, and I'll just read it here. Executive Order 5-16 states that city authorities will not cooperate with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, detainer requests for undocumented citizens who are arrested and would have otherwise been released from custody unless the individual has committed a first or second degree felony involving violence. The mayor has stated he will do everything he can to maintain that policy. So it seems, at least in Philadelphia, Jan, that the Kinney administration is making a decision between people who commit a violent crime versus someone, let's say, is pulled over for driving without a driver's license.
Well, there's a vast middle ground of people who have committed serious crimes that the immigration authorities would like to know and talk to. You know, the policy of non-cooperation results in people who have committed crimes being released onto the streets. I think it's clearly a federal responsibility to enforce our immigration laws. The federal government law enforcement agencies are prepared to do so. They need cooperation of local authorities who often have people in custody in which the immigration authorities have an interest. And I just think it's a betrayal of public safety. And it's also a violation of federal law. There are clear immigration statutes on the books, including 8 U.S.C. 1373, which oblige cities like Philadelphia to cooperate. And indeed, Philadelphia is on the Department of Justice top 10 list of cities in violation of 8 U.S.C. 1373. And it is going to result absolutely in the cutoff of Justice Department funding for specific programs, including justice assistance grants, criminal alien assistance grants, cops hiring program grants. Those will be cut off in the current fiscal year, the 2017.
Well, and you're talking about
year.
The Obama administration,
yes,
not the Trump
administration. The Obama administration has been under pressure from the Republican Congress to call sanctuary cities on these problems because it's a clear violation of the law. The law mandates cutoff of funds in these justice programs. Of course, the Trump administration says they're going to go even further and cut off all federal funding. We'll see whether that actually
go
happens.
Go ahead, Peter
so
Spiro.
So the Philadelphia policy does not violate 8 U.S.C. 1373, which only requires that it bars state and local governments from prohibiting the sending to or receiving from information regarding the citizenship or immigration status of any individual. So that has nothing to do with detention policy. In fact, Philadelphia's detention policy and that of other so-called sanctuary cities is merely respecting the Fourth Amendment, that one cannot be detained without charge beyond a certain period of time, generally agreed to be 48 hours. The leading Supreme Court opinion on this question is a Scalia opinion. And so it's just that the city is saying we're not going – people that we would otherwise release after being arrested, we're not going to prolong their detention in anticipation of ICE enforcement action.
Well, so, and let me just pick up on this because it's interesting that Mayor Kenney calls Philadelphia a Fourth Amendment city. Which
is very – it's a very appropriate label for this refusal to hold people – beyond the time that they would ordinarily be held under the criminal enforcement, the enforcement of criminal laws for purposes of ICE follow-up. So this is a completely appropriate action on the part of the cities with respect to the detainer policies.
And are we talking about things like people driving without a driver's
absolutely.
License?
Absolutely. And the other thing to keep in mind here, and this is why there's been so much resistance in cities such as Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, L.A., is that you're talking about undocumented aliens who are very much embedded in our community. So these are parents of American citizens, spouses of American citizens, individuals who have been here sometimes for decades out of status. All of a sudden they get caught up with some minor traffic violation or a minor criminal law violation, and they're being put in the pipeline for deportation to a country they haven't been to for years and being really yanked out of the community that is now theirs.
Jan, let me go back to you because I guess you could say by definition, people who are in this country illegally have broken the law. Should we think of them as criminals? And should we treat all people who are here in violation of immigration laws as criminals, therefore should be deported?
Whose responsibility is it to answer your questions? Under our system of government, the Congress of the United States makes those decisions and enacts them into law. Congress has spoken. Congress has enacted a complicated legal system to specify what our immigration laws are and how they should be enforced. Congress decides who's deportable. Right, not you
even,
or I.
No,
but Congress decides, and once Congress makes that decision, we have agencies that are authorized to enforce the decisions that Congress has made. I mean, I think this detention issue is the least important part of the sanctuary cities dispute. What's really at stake is cooperation. And cooperation doesn't necessarily mean detention. It means when you've got somebody that you're going to release, giving a phone call to another law enforcement agency saying, look, we're going to release this person at a certain time on a certain day. You know, if you're interested in this person, you better send somebody over here to talk to them and take them into custody if you have the authority to do so. But everything ought to be in accordance with the law. Everyone agrees with that. But the important question that we forget is who makes the law? Who makes the law? And the answer is our elected representatives and a process determined by the Constitution. So if people are going to say, you know, not my immigration laws, they're saying not my Constitution. If you don't believe in the constitutional process, then, you know, you can attack the immigration laws as unconstitutional. But I think if you believe in the Constitution, they're clearly constitutional.
Go ahead, Peter.
Just one thing off the top. Being in the United States in violation of the immigration laws is not a crime.
It's not
a civil offense. That's certainly the case with respect to those who entered the country legally, which is about 40% of all undocumented aliens entered the country legally. On this question, sure, of course, Congress defines who was here. It's in charge of the immigration laws. But this is a question of enforcement. And so if Congress and the federal government wants to enforce the immigration laws, then they should go ahead and do it. But it's actually, again, as a matter of constitutional law, and another Justice Scalia opinion here in the 1997 case in Prince versus United States, which holds that the federal government cannot commandeer state and local officials to enforce federal law. So this is perfectly constitutional for state and local governments to say, look, we're just not going to be a part of this, and you can't force us to be.
We're almost up at a break here. You both sent us notes in preparation for today's show, and one of the things that you sent, Peter, was a kind of don't ask, don't tell policy. Is that essentially what sanctuary cities are doing?
Absolutely, Nan. So they're in the various ways in which individuals engage with local government, including law enforcement, these cities now generally have a policy of just not inquiring into immigration status, and they have no duty to do so. And since they don't have the information regarding immigration status as a result, there's really no lack of cooperation or exchange of information. It's just information that these state and local governments don't collect.
Needless to say, I disagree with that characterization. A don't ask, don't tell policy would be allowing state and local officers to have regular contact with the Immigration Service and exchange whatever information they, as law enforcement officers, want to do. This is just the opposite. This is political politicians getting in the middle and saying you cannot talk and share information with your federal law enforcement officers. So it's not a passive policy. It's an active intervention in what would otherwise be normal cooperation between law enforcement officials.
We are debating sanctuary cities with our guests Jan Ting and Peter Spiro. And you can join us by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Already the comments are coming in. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, hosting a vigorous conversation both on and off the air with our guest, Jan Ting. He's a professor at Temple University Beasley School of Law. He was an assistant commissioner at the INS, and he's a blogger for WHYY. Peter Spiro, a professor also at Temple University Beasley School of Law, wrote a book, came out just a couple of months ago, called At Home in Two Countries, about dual citizenship. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me throw out something to both of you. We have these mayors, de Blasio in Los Angeles, in Chicago, other mayors as well, are basically saying to the new Trump administration, We are a sanctuary city. We're going to stay that way. Can they be arrested, Jan Ting?
Well, I don't think so, and I don't think anyone is suggesting that. People are suggesting that the federal government has the authority to cut off funding for these cities. And, you know, some cities are wealthy enough. San Francisco is wealthy enough, so they can say, oh, we don't need that funding. We're going to stay sanctuary cities. You know, New York appears to be pretty prosperous. A lot of rich people are moving capital
into New York City. Because they can afford it, you're saying?
Yeah, maybe they can afford it. Philadelphia, as we know, is not a rich city. It's just the opposite. It is a poor city, and it is going to pay a high price if they persist in emulating the rich cities that can basically thumb their nose. I mean, the politics of this are clear. Sanctuary cities was an issue. Sanctuary cities are one of the reasons Pat Toomey is still a United States senator from Pennsylvania. It's one of the reasons why Pennsylvania flipped from an Obama state to a Trump state. So you got to play to your constituency. If you're playing to an urban constituency, maybe you can sell sanctuary cities. But if you're playing to a statewide constituency, you're in trouble.
What do you think, Peter?
I don't think that this is necessarily going to come to that. I don't think
are they
necessarily
in defiance of the law?
Well, no, they're not in defiance of the law. Now, it is true that in theory, the federal government has this leverage with respect to federal funds, which at least to the extent that they can be rationally connected to enforce immigration and law enforcement, they could be cut off. There's the South Dakota versus Dole decision in 1987, which upheld that kind of action on the part of the federal government. But if you look at I'm not sure that this makes political sense from the Trump administration's perspective. I mean, here we're talking about jurisdictions that are welcoming to immigrants, including undocumented immigrants. And so it could be a question of just, okay, if New York and Philadelphia, Chicago and LA want to sort of maintain this community that is inclusive of undocumented aliens, why do we need to force a confrontation here? From their perspective, the better tack may be to allow those jurisdictions that are anti-immigration to ramp up enforcement of federal law. And so the other side of this picture is to enter into sort of deputization agreements with jurisdictions like Arizona and southern states, the kinds of states that passed SB 1070 type laws that are very unfriendly to undocumented immigrants. That would make sense from their perspective. Those are the constituencies that were demanding ramped up enforcement of federal immigration law.
Are you comfortable with that, Jan Ting?
Well, I think in
more
that,
local control
in that
over
previous
these laws?
Debate, it became settled law that immigration law is almost exclusively a federal responsibility, and there's a very limited role for state and local government to play. I mean, I felt a lot of that may have been decided in the Civil War. You can't have a state or a local immigration policy separate from the federal government's policy. We have one immigration policy for the entire United States, and I think it is the responsibility of the federal government to enforce that policy, whether it's in Arizona or whether it's in Philadelphia. And I think the incoming administration has said that they're going to do so. And I take them at their word.
This has nothing to do with the Civil War. This is about federalism.
This is
and respecting local preferences. We have all kinds of variations with respect to all kinds of different laws, including with respect to immigration law. And so this is an area in which we can tolerate variation. And so that those jurisdictions that are okay with immigration and okay with undocumented immigrants, that preference should be respected. Those jurisdictions that are unhappy about it, well, then they can go to work, and they'll also end up – they can shoulder the consequences.
This is a reflection of nullification doctrine, a discredited legal doctrine that says, oh, you know, states and localities don't have to obey federal laws with which they disagree. I think that's a discredited doctrine. And frankly, we saw in the SB 1070 case that Peter mentioned –
this is Arizona, right?
Yeah, where most of SB 1070 was slapped down on grounds that conflicted with
federal law. So here's the
change
in the Trump administration is that – and with majorities in both houses of Congress, if SB 1070 like measures were expressly validated by Congress and the president, then it's not a problem. I mean, then that the Supreme Court's decision is basically irrelevant.
Are you advocating that?
Well, I'd say that's a direction that I see as a more promising one for the Trump administration. If Arizona wants to be tough on immigration, let them be tough on immigration and let them shoulder the consequences of being tough on immigration.
Let me try out something. And this, again, in preparation for the show, one of the arguments, I guess, for a sanctuary city is that local law enforcement responsible for local public safety, believing that if you threaten people with possible deportation because they don't have a driver's license and they're driving a car, that then you break the kind of trust that you need as local law enforcement to be able to really get to the bad guys and the bad girls, if I can put it that way, to the true criminals. And that by creating a sanctuary city, you allow for some give and take and more trust between local law enforcement and the people that they're here to protect.
Who should make that decision? Should it be an elected politician or should it be a cop walking a beat? The cop knows his beat. You know, let the cop make the decision. If the cop wants to talk to federal immigration enforcement officials, let the cop do so.
You have to have policies at the municipal level for this kind of thing. And generally,
but doesn't
speaking,
a sanctuary city give a cop some degree of discretion in this, or maybe not? I don't know.
I think, generally speaking, especially in urban areas, law enforcement is just not interested in enforcing federal immigration laws because it's not part of their core mission. Their core mission is keeping the streets safe. And that has nothing to do with immigration.
But who's law enforcement? You know, who's local law enforcement?
If the federal government wants to enforce the immigration laws, they can send ICE guys out on the beat and do their enforcing.
You're the one that said
there's no interference. Is that something you recommend, Peter? I mean, the idea ICE wants to do that, then let them be on the street?
Well, I think that, again, is it would pose a real political dilemma for the Trump administration because I think it would result in some real confrontations.
Right.
I think that this is that undocumented immigrants are part of these communities to the extent that federal immigration enforcement starts doing raids or street checks and the like. I think we may see something on the order of civil disobedience. I think there may be real confrontations. I think we may see protection of undocumented immigrants in sanctuaries, more literal sanctuaries.
Law enforcement requires coordination. Coordination is a big word in law enforcement. You bring in other agencies. No agency can act unilaterally without coordinating with other agencies. That's what we need, more coordination, more sharing of information, more backup where one agency has the other agency's back. That's how law enforcement is done. That's what makes it successful.
But aren't there jurisdictions where you've got levels of law enforcement responsible for
yes.
different parts of our...
And you need to coordinate. That's why, you know, if you're going to do a raid, you have to coordinate with the local authorities and say, look, here's what we're working on, and we need your backup. We need you there on site in case something goes wrong so that we have protection. All agencies operate that way. Everyone backs everybody else up. And I think there's political interference in what is normal cooperation among law enforcement officers and agencies is troubling.
This is not political interference. This is about protecting communities. This is about protecting families. This activity is not just about cooperating to do ordinary law enforcement. This is about dividing people. And if Arizona wants to do that, okay, let them do it. But if cities like Philadelphia are going to stand up for the community and for families and for people that have been here for a long time, then that seems, as a moral matter, the right way to go.
Congress,
it's not politics.
Congress
this is reflecting community preferences.
Congress makes the laws. If anyone thinks immigration laws are unconstitutional, they need to bring a case. That's been tried many times. The courts have repeatedly said, as Peter knows, that making the immigration laws is left exclusively to the political branches. And that is a policy that has been upheld again and again.
But here
by
we're
the
talking about enforcing the immigration laws, and there is no constitutional requirement that state and local law enforcement cooperate with the enforcement of federal immigration law.
But you admit there's interference in the
normal
cooperation.
That's just not cooperating.
The street cop is not allowed to cooperate.
But you're saying
this is not our business.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you, Peter Spiro and Jan Ting, our guests in this hour of Radio Times, a vigorous and fascinating debate on sanctuary cities. They are both professors at Temple University here in Philadelphia. I should add that Philadelphia is a sanctuary city. Mayor Kenney calls it a Fourth Amendment city, and there are sanctuary cities across the country. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just read a bunch of comments here. One from so much to choose from. One from Raymond. Make a program to legalize those who are here and stop new ones from overstaying their visas or crossing the border. A comment from Peter. Right. Never mind about that. A comment from Tim. Open borders are good. Just ask the people your relatives displaced. A comment from Barry. First of all, it's all about illegal immigration, not just immigration. Secondly, the issue is more whether local police should cooperate in regards to undocumented immigrants who have committed other crimes. And this is where it gets, I think, a little complicated. There are the sort of minor infractions that the people commit, whether they're here illegally or whether they're here legally. And then there are much more serious crimes. And do you think, Peter, that we have a system that can decide between the two?
So this has been the approach of the Obama administration to prioritize the removal of criminal aliens, and that it, and criminal defined so that it's focused on serious criminal aliens. And I think, in fact, that's going to be the approach that the Trump administration takes, at least with respect to setting a national baseline for national policy. That is problematic in some ways. I mean, we deport these gang members to Central America, and it's not like we're deporting them to Mars. Mm. What they do is they just set up the San Salvador branch of the Crips or the Bloods, and then creates a situation in which we're facing a flood of refugees. So even that's problematic. But as a political matter, it's clear that that's something that even the Obama administration agreed on, right, with respect to the priorities. And I think that that's what we'll see in the future. But minor crimes, that's a different story, because, again, here you're talking about people that in many cases have been here for a long time. They're parents of American citizens. They're spouses of American citizens. They're green card holders in many cases. Whether they should be deported for relatively minor crimes, that's a completely different issue.
What's a minor crime? Is shoplifting a minor crime?
I think so. Yeah, I've been here.
Driving under the influence, a minor crime?
Yes.
Resulting in injury to innocent people? Is that a minor crime?
If somebody's been here for 20 years and has an American citizen family, should they be? They can serve their time under
the position
under
of
the
President-elect Trump from the very beginning, from the moment he announced his candidacy, up on his website, still DonaldJTrump.com, is the statement that all criminal aliens should be removed from the United States. All.
Which is about 800,000 something.
Well, you know, it's a large number. If you include people who are, you know, repeat shoplifters and people who drive drunk and result in injury to other people, that's a lot of people. Again, we're not talking about U.S. citizens. We're talking about non-citizens.
Resident aliens.
Well, Peter, let me toss it to you. I mean, are you saying that then people who are here illegally should be treated like people who are natural born citizens when it comes to crimes that they have committed, whether it's shoplifting or something more?
Well, so one thing that gets lost here is that if non-citizens commit crimes, they face the full force of the enforcement of the criminal laws. So if they're repeat shoplifters and there are criminal penalties that attach to that activity, then they're not immunized from that. So if there's jail time associated with it, then they should go to jail. If there's jail time associated with DUI, those people should go to jail. But if you've been here for 20 years as a green card holder and you've got U.S. citizen children, U.S. citizen spouse, you've got work here, you've got property, you've got nothing back in your country of nationality, should you be deported because you've been convicted of a DUI offense? That seems cruel and unusual.
So once someone, let's say they serve some time because they're repeat offenders, once they're released from jail, then they can go back to their life?
That should be the case, except when it comes to more serious crimes.
When it involves violence.
Violence, serious crimes of various descriptions, then there's clearly a political consensus that those individuals should be released.
You know, underlying the challenge to our immigration laws and enforcement is, I think, a core belief that people are people, you know, and that we ought not distinguish between U.S. citizens on the one hand and non-citizens on the other hand. The other side of that argument is, no, nation states still matter. Citizenship still matters. And it makes sense for us to have greater loyalty to our fellow citizens than we do to people who are not in our citizenship group. And that, I think, is the underlying tension over immigration laws is how we view citizenship and whether it's still important, whether we feel a greater fraternity with our fellow citizens than with non-citizens, especially those who have just wandered in here and are here without permission.
But, Peter, does this go back to the fact that we have not been able to come up with any kind of reform of our immigration system? Things get stuck in Congress. They don't move
absolutely
out.
And that's given rise to the phenomenon of about 11 million undocumented aliens, many of whom have been here for many years. Now, on the citizenship point, citizenship does not map out onto community. And so one thing that's driving the sanctuary cities movement is the fact that these people are, as a practical matter, citizens of these communities. They are members of the community. And that's what has given rise to this protective instinct. And very interesting initiative in New York State to actually give New York State citizenship to individuals.
You can do that?
Regardless of their – it's a proposal, but it's interesting as a proposal to the extent that these people are, for all intents and purposes, as social members, citizens of the state of New York.
What do you think about that, Jan Tingle? Well, almost up at a break, but go
you
ahead.
You know, I Congress makes the laws. One of the reasons so-called immigration reform failed is because Congress felt the laws we have now are better than what was proposed as immigration reform. And I think many members of Congress today would say we just need to enforce the rules that are already on the books. We hear that all the time. And so that is a choice that Congress makes. Congress makes those laws. They need to be enforced. If the country means anything, if citizenship means anything, then we need to draw the distinctions that Congress wants us to make.
With the notion that under Congress's description, everyone who's here illegally should be deported? Should
everyone who's here in violation of our immigration laws is certainly deportable. Obviously, we don't have the resources to deport every single one of them, but are we making good use of the resources that are available? Are we going out and expending the resources to remove as many people as possible from those Congress has identified as warranting removal?
That is Jan Tang, who joins us along with Peter Spiro. We are talking about debating, discussing, digging deep into the notion of sanctuary cities and the Trump administration. President-elect Donald Trump has said that he will withhold federal funds from communities that serve as sanctuary cities, and that could be Philadelphia. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Just a recap here. Donald Trump campaigned on the promise of cutting funds to so-called sanctuary cities, and he has said that within his first 100 days, he will cut off those funds to sanctuary cities. There are a bunch of them, including Philadelphia. They've been around for years, and are they on a collision course with this new administration? And again, our guests are both professors at Temple University Law School, Peter Spiro and Jan Tingle. Let me get Rocco from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Rocco, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
So I just had a comment. As a prison social worker for the last 9 years, I can say that the issue of Philadelphia being a sanctuary city doesn't play out with the cops on the beat. It plays out in the county jail where when an immigrant is arrested, they get an ICE detainer dropped. So then it's the it's the job of the prison to honor that ICE detainer or let people go. And as a social worker, I can say that very often these ICE detainers were granted, and then the federal authorities would come and pick up the immigrant and take them to Harrisburg or whatever the detention facility was. So I think it's kind of a moot point of whether the cop on the beat is making this call to the federal authorities. It's really going on at the prison, and I will say that very often these ICE detainers were honored.
Well, that's fascinating, Rocco. I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Peter, you have a quizzical look on your face.
So the reason that it plays out this way is that when somebody's arrested, there's a check against an FBI database, and that is what identifies somebody as being here out of status. So the determination there is being made easily, and it is the case that all state and local law enforcement makes use of this database. Now, the detainers are being respected. This is where you get the variation. They're being respected in some counties. So out in the middle of Pennsylvania, I'm sure they're being respected. But this is where we could see the variation in that communities that don't want to comply with the detainers and their constitutional justifications for not doing so. There's no constitutional requirement that they do so. That's where the question is.
Let me read something I downloaded from the ACLU about these ICE detainers. Now, according to the ACLU, Dan, it says an ICE detainer request is just that, a request. There's no legal requirement for your department to comply. The federal government has no legal right to force your department to hold anyone beyond the time when they are eligible for release from state or local custody.
I don't disagree with that. I think what is required is cooperation between the law enforcement agencies. I think that where a detainer request has been made, it'd be nice to give a phone call to ICE and say, all right, this person that you've got a detainer request on is going to be released. And so if you want to do anything, this is your opportunity to do so. So that's a different thing than saying, oh, after, you know, we would have released him, we're going to hold him for another week so ICE can come in and take them. I don't think that's what ICE is really asking for. They're just asking for a courtesy call. Give us a courtesy call so we can do our mission of law enforcement. That's all they're asking for, and there ought to be that level of cooperation. I just want to say, you know, why do we have to enforce immigration laws? Because, as the critics often say, building a wall on the southern border is not enough. It's not going to stop illegal immigration. You can't physically prevent people that are determined to come in to come in. But why are people determined to come in? You know, one of my colleagues at Temple used to say, the poor people of the world may be poor, but they're not stupid. They're as capable of using cost-benefit analysis to determine what's in their own self-interest as any one of us. And he said, you know, if you want more illegal immigration, all you have to do is lower the costs and raise the benefits. Oh, you live in a sanctuary city. Mm-hmm. If you want less illegal immigration, you have to raise the costs and lower the benefits. You will get less. Building a wall is part of that strategy, but by itself, it cannot work.
Do we know, Peter, that sanctuary cities are a haven then for people who are here illegally? Do we know that?
I very much doubt that they are a factor in a would-be illegal immigrant's decision to make the trek. I don't think there are people out there saying, oh, I'm going to go to Philadelphia because I know it's a sanctuary city. So I don't think that's really – I don't think that's a factor here. And again, the question is, if the people of Philadelphia want to have immigrants regardless of their immigration status, what's the problem? Mm. Why should you be concerned about it? I mean, especially when these are immigrants who have been here for many years, who have U.S. citizen families, who have jobs, who are productive members of this community.
Well, this is what President-elect Donald Trump has said, is that he is going to punish these cities by withholding federal funds. We're not sure how much or what departments or any of that, Jan. But and to you, Peter, as well, which is it's one thing to have this idea, not just an intellectual idea, but a belief, philosophy. And then there's the price you might pay for that.
There are numerous examples.
And thanks, Rocco, for the call, by the way.
Numerous examples of innocent Americans killed by aliens who were in detention but were released by agencies who did not respond to government detainer requests. I mean, the Kate Steinle case in San Francisco is a high-profile case, but there are numerous others.
How many
with
do you
names.
Think?
Well, there's a website called theRememberanceProject.org, which is a memorial to all the Americans murdered by people who are not here, many of whom were actually in detention at various times, but in detention in sanctuary cities. So there is a public safety dimension to it, but more than that, it's about enforcing immigration laws so that the immigration laws are respected. If you don't enforce the laws, the immigration laws will not be respected. Mm. You think we've got an illegal immigration problem now, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Go ahead, Peter. I know you want to respond to that.
So on the point on the criminal aliens who undertake acts of violence, that's really a Willie Horton approach to the issue. Of course, I mean, aliens are not angels. They're not all angels. Just like other groups aren't all angels, I'm sure there are grandmothers out there who have committed terrible murders. There are veterans out there who have committed terrible murders, and we don't let the bad apple taint the whole barrel. And so that's just a fallacy. It plays to certain psychological ways of processing information that, oh, well, if we deported all aliens, then we would have then we would have prevented that murder. I mean, obviously, any murder is something to be lamented, but we can't tag a whole group of people. Mm. And the studies all show that aliens controlling for socioeconomic and other demographic factors, that non-citizens, including undocumented aliens, are no more prone to commit crimes than other people.
Let me get, looks like, what do we have? Is it Lou? Do we have Lou next coming from Philadelphia? If not Lou, it's William. No, go ahead. Yes. It's Lou, yes. from Philadelphia. Lou, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for having this show.
You're welcome.
I like the opinion of your guests regarding the ability of the federal government to actually make good on the threat of cutting off funds to sanctuary cities. Specifically, I'm asking because in 2012, when the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, it also held that the federal government could not cut off Medicaid funding to states that chose not to expand Medicaid. In other words, right, the federal government couldn't compel that state action. Do your guests think that that case might have any bearing in this context, where the federal government may once again be trying to use the carrot or the stick of federal funding to affect local policy?
That's interesting, Lou. I appreciate the call. Jan, can I start with you, and then Peter, I'll go to
you. I don't know anything about the Affordable Care Act. I can just say that in terms of cutting off federal funding, there are already laws on the books, and I've mentioned one, 8 U.S.C. 1373. Anyone can look it up. And the Obama administration has been pressured by the Republican Congress to recognize that that applies to sanctuary cities, and the Obama administration has the Office of the Inspector General and the Department of Justice has identified the top 10 sanctuary cities who are targets for cutoff of federal spending, and specifically $342 million in Department of Justice grants. So that mechanism is underway now. When President-elect Trump comes into office in January, he's going to be well positioned. All these cities have been notified that they're not going to be receiving additional Department of Justice grants going forward, and that can be implemented by the incoming administration.
So we'll see if that actually comes to pass. But the question's a very good one, and the law is a little unsettled here in how it would apply in this case. So the key case is South Dakota versus Dole, a 1987 case under which the federal government made federal highway grants contingent on states reducing their speed limit to 55. So there was a clear connection between the grants and the condition. So I don't think that the Trump administration could cut off all funding, so things that were not remotely related to immigration enforcement. Now, they probably could cut off some Justice Department funding for these states and local governments. And then you're right. Mm. It'll force these jurisdictions to sort of put their money where their mouth is. And my guess is that even the not rich jurisdictions, because we're talking about protecting members of the communities, will take the hit.
Lou, I appreciate the call. Let me get William now from Westchester to join our conversation. Hi, William. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, throughout the national dialogue we've been having about immigration, I very rarely hear anything about the employers of illegal immigrants. And it would seem to me that employing illegal immigrants is part of the incentive that makes people come to this country. And I was just wondering if I could get your speakers to comment on that.
Sure.
Why are we not penalizing the employers of illegal aliens and just sort of focusing on the illegal immigrants themselves?
I hear you.
There are laws on the books to penalize employers, but the problem in all immigration-related laws is that they're not enforced. The employer lobby is very powerful in the United States, and there are actually cases on the books that say as long as the employer looks at a counterfeit document, if it looks good on its face, that's good enough. Mm-hmm. You can go ahead and hire them. The Trump administration has promised that when they take office, they're going to mandate a system called E-Verify that already exists, the electronic verification of ID numbers, Social Security numbers, most people think that will have a dramatic impact on the inability of unauthorized persons to get legal employment in the United States. There's a huge counterfeit documents industry out there, and they produce very good copies of counterfeit documents. But E-Verify should put an end to most of that.
Peter, is there kind of don't ask, don't tell when it comes to the employment of people who are here illegally?
So I agree with I mean, there are laws on the books and that have been under enforced. I think we'll see a return to some Bush administration practices involving workplace raids. So that's going to be one area in which we'll see ramped up enforcement. E-Verify, I mean, that may reduce at the margins the levels of unauthorized employment, but it's not going to stop people from independent contractors from hiring undocumented aliens. So I think it'll be a marginal impact.
What I hear from both of you, and frankly anyone that talks about immigration and people who are here illegally, is that there's just no way to deport everybody. So don't you have to kind of pick and choose then who you are either going to – who gets applied – who – I'm stumbling my words here. But who has to live under certain laws and who doesn't? Peter?
Absolutely. So it costs about $10,000 on average to deport an individual from the United States. And Congress to date has allocated – enough in the budget to deport about 400,000 undocumented aliens. And that's the number that the Obama administration was deporting. Really, the innovation with, and it has always been the case through Democrat and Republican administrations, that there has been a prioritization. The innovation of the Obama administration was to make that prioritization more formal, so that it was as a matter of policy that they would prioritize the removal of criminal aliens and that others would basically be put at the bottom of the stack, which, given the limited budgetary resources, right, meant that they never were gotten to. So, you know, when Trump talks about the mass deportations, for starters, it's unlikely to happen because it would be so expensive.
Of course there have to be priorities. And President-elect Trump has said, you know, the priority is going to be removal of all criminal aliens from the United States. That's his priority. But the important thing is that by nationalizing the priority system, it meant that based on different localities, some localities had removal capacity that wasn't being used. By allowing local enforcement to enforce to the extent of their resources, local federal enforcement agencies, that makes sure that you're not wasting federal resources, that the resources that are available for removals are in fact removing people based on local priorities, right? Who's available for removal in your district, not on a national district. So, and again, you have to have the perception of enforcement, because if the perception grows out there that, well, if you don't commit a serious crime, there's really no chance of your being removed from the United States, that alters the cost-benefit of analysis of people trying to come to the United States illegally, makes them more willing to climb the wall because they know as long as they don't commit a so-called serious crime, there's no chance of their being removed.
So during the Obama administration, the number of illegal border crossings has declined precipitously. So that if it is a cost-benefit calculation, it's changed so as to diminish the levels of undocumented immigration. On the local prioritization, I agree with Jan. And I think that's the direction that we're going to go in, and that is that those jurisdictions that care about cracking down on undocumented immigration are going to be given a much greater, much freer rein to do so. The other side of that is that jurisdictions that don't care about undocumented immigration should not be forced into a situation where they're participating in the crackdown.
Well, we have come full circle and we've covered a lot of territory, and I really appreciate both of you coming in and talking about this really important issue. Jan Tin, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Pleasure for us as well. He's a professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. He served as assistant commissioner at the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and he's a blogger for WHYY. Peter Spiro, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
It.
And he's the Charles Wiener Professor of Law, also at Temple University Beasley School of Law. He's got a new book called At Home in Two Countries, and it's about dual citizenship. We appreciate all the comments and calls to Radio Times on this important issue. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.